It's the top of the hour, and you're listening to WCOM LP FM Radio, Carrboro Chapel Hill. I'm your host, Molly Matlock, director of the Chatham County Arts Council, taking you inside the artist studio each Tuesday from 4 to 5 p.m. You can live stream the show at www.wcomfm.org. Be sure to visit us and make a donation while you're there. Like all nonprofits, community radio does not live on love alone. And to learn about Chatham Arts, cultural events, classes, youth arts programs, gallery, and more, visit www.chathamarts.org. And today on Inside the Artist Studio, I'm interviewing photographer Bryce Lankard about his new book, Land of Dreams, and much more. He is here from Charlotte today and has won multiple awards, including being named Photographer of the Year, and his work has been published in the New York Times Magazine, Rolling Stone, Spin, Forbes, Newsweek, and The Village Voice, to name a few, and has been exhibited at the 92nd Street Y in New York. So, Bryce, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Good to be here.
You said you got to walk around town, experience Carrboro a little bit.
Beautiful fall day. Gorgeous. Yes.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. So, you know, when I sent you the questions for the interview, I started with the signature question that I ask everyone, and that is to get you to share a story about an early memory you have of an arts experience really making a profound effect on you.
All right. Well, certainly, you know, my creative or arts experiences probably began with my mother. She was very creative, all kinds of stuff, crafts and stuff, encouraged myself and my sister to take part in all that stuff. But probably the one that ended up making the most profound impact on me was we had these, you know, photo albums and home movies, which I would visit and revisit and revisit. And at some point when you've seen them enough, you stop looking at them for the people that you know in the pictures. And I started seeing them as really remarkable records of a time, a culture. My snapshot grandfather ended up having a pretty good eye. And it really informed a lot of what I think I moved forward with. In fact, the home movies are what inspired me. I wanted to be a filmmaker. In fact, I came to Chapel Hill wanting to learn how to make films. And, of course, the year I got here, they dropped film production from the curriculum.
I didn't know they ever had film production.
Used to be called Rumpty Vump, Radio, Television, and Motion Picture Production. And at that time, I guess silver got very expensive. Mm-hmm. And so film stock was made out of silver. So you could study film theory, film criticism. But as far as the production, it was all then television-based, which they taught it like you were going to be on a live TV show, which is not really what I was interested in doing. So everything sort of shifted back towards still photography. So those things, I continue to try to replicate what I saw in my own photo albums to this day.
Well, what was the film that you wanted to make?
Oh, gosh. You know, I'm a big buff. I'm a storyteller of all kinds. And so I don't know that I had a film in mind when I came here. I just knew I loved imagery and loved the way images are used to tell a story.
Yeah. So who are some of the filmmakers and photographers who made kind of an impact on you?
Well, I was lucky when inadvertently changed my direction from moving pictures to stills. Not only was I surrounded by a great group of peers, my fellow students in Chapel Hill, but took every single photography class the university offered at that time. Even took outside classes at the Carrboro Art School back in the day when I was an undergraduate. Couldn't get enough. And it was probably people like Henri Cartier-Bresson, Dean Arbus, and probably my favorite was Robert Frank. I really gravitated at that time to sort of the street photographers.
Yeah, what do you think it was about them that really drew your eye?
Well, you know, at the time, you know, I was taking certainly the photojournalism classes that was offered at Carolina, and I graded under what they defined as making a good sort of daily newspaper picture. They, to me, seemed to be overly simplified things. I know that one of the things I used to say is if you're writing a story for the paper, you need to be able to write it in such a way that someone with a fifth grade education can read and understand. Well, the same applied for the pictures. And sort of the analogy was, if let's say you're taking a sports picture, what made a good sports picture is an image with a face and a ball. And that was it, you know. And those just, they didn't say enough to me. And I wanted to have more content. I wanted to have a lot of stuff in an image. I wanted you to be able to look at it and look at it and look at it and make you question things. And you know, beautiful composition. And all those people in their own way, those photographers I mentioned, have that in their images. So that really attracted me.
So when did, or do you know when photography began being considered an art and not just
a
reflection of news?
I think that's still a struggle. I think they you know, from the very beginning, it wanted to be considered that. And I'm sure there are still folks out there today who even question that. Certainly the early photographers tried to mimic, you know, sort of romantic paintings. But I think the medium is the best medium out there. The range of possible expression within photography is so diverse and so expressive. I think its potential is unlimited. And I think nowadays, this is sort of another one of the questions on your list, but with the demise of a lot of the big picture magazines and venues for what I do, you know, sort of, for lack of a better term, fine art documentary, that a lot of those same practitioners don't have venues for what they do outside of sort of a gallery or art space. So a lot of the work is, you know, being housed under the umbrella of art now, because there's no other place to put it out there. So I think it is art, no question.
Yeah. Why do you feel that there's such a broad range of expression? What are things that a lot of people don't think about when they think about photography? And maybe aren't practitioners.
It's one of its greatest strengths is also probably one of its drawbacks, in that as a medium, it's so democratic and so accessible. Everybody has a camera. Everybody sees pictures every day. You know, your phone now has a camera in it. So, people are used to that. Sort of the language of it is you know, more in the common sort of vernacular. But at the same time, a lot of people will look at a great image and go, well, I could do that. And the fact of the matter is, they probably can't. A, they didn't, and maybe they can't. There's such craft, and now with the rise of digital photography and cameras that are so smart, technically people can easily just point and shoot and snap a technically well-exposed, focused, auto-focused image, and too often don't think about the craft of I don't want to say masters, but you know, composition, the timing, and I see a backlash to some of this digital stuff, you know, the ease and speed with which it's done. I see a whole shift back towards sort of legacy ways of making images. Film, but even, you know, wet plate collodion and photogravures and you name it, things that really involve the hand of the artist, the hand of the photographer in the process. In digital, you almost never actually touch anything. A computer key, that's about it.
Well, how do you think that maybe you see the world differently because of your practice of photography?
I never turn off my eye. I really don't. I'm always sort of critically looking. You know, you can look without seeing, but I'm always trying to see, you know, moments, combinations, light, graphic patterns, things that say something. I'm always looking. My origins were definitely street photography, where I had a camera with me all the time. So I was always looking. For reasons maybe we'll talk about, I kind of drifted away from that. And the great irony is, you know, I just got my new favorite toy the other day. I got an iPhone. And, you know, I love the camera on it, this hipstamatic thing. And oddly enough, I'm back to being, I find myself being a street photographer again. Now I do. Now I do have that camera with me again all the time. And boy, oh boy, do I use it. Man, I'm shooting like crazy with this thing. And it's, you know, there's whole debates about that, too. There's a great article, a great blog. The New York Times has a photo blog, which is really wonderful. And there's been this recent hullabaloo about this guy who won some photojournalism-type award. He had been embedded with soldiers and did this whole story on them using nothing but the Hipstamatic application on his iPhone. And, you know, purists were in an absolute uproar over this. You know, it was the end of journalism and so on and so forth. But I just, you know, I totally disagree with that. I, you know, read that and also recently have been...
Why were they in such an uproar? Why?
Well, because they feel like this, you know, these computer filters and things that the application automatically does to flavor the image were sort of cheapening it, and yet the photographer himself took some time but wrote a very thoughtful response to this, and that, you know, he uses the most subtle of these things, and none of them are things that he wouldn't have done or somebody else wouldn't have done in the computer, on photo, in Photoshop, in the darkroom, had they been working in a darkroom. You know, nothing dramatic, a little saturation, a little vignetting, a little, you know, something like that. And this particular program happens to shoot in a square format, which I can certainly side with this guy. I now adore shooting in a square, and that he does too. And so that's that. But his ultimate conclusion was that it's not the program taking the pictures, it is me taking the pictures. It's my eye, my sensibility, my composition, my empathy, and the little bit of aesthetic applied to it doesn't change anything. And that's what's so funny is, just again this past week, I've started to learn a little bit more about this thing called the Photo League, which was an old group in New York, which disbanded ultimately because they were deemed sort of subversive and communist. And a lot of people don't, I didn't know a lot of the names in this, but they were doing what they would call documentary photography, not necessarily journalism, not the daily news stuff, but sort of long-term stuff. And part of their ongoing debates and mission was applying an aesthetic to their documentary work. Well, that's the exact same thing this guy was doing. He's just applying an aesthetic. And you know, so when I describe my work, you know, I do say, I call it sort of fine art documentary, that I am trying to apply a style, a look, a flavor to my stuff. I don't want it to be generic. I want it to have some sort of you know, artistic merit as well.
Well, it's amazing to me that you can take a whole class, you know, of, you know, photography students to a single place and then get, you know, a million different shots. Because what each person chooses to focus on in that same spot is completely different. Their perspective is so different. What perspective do you think characterizes your work and makes it uniquely yours?
Well, you know, I'm constantly re-examining my own work, and it certainly has evolved a lot over the years. I like to say most of that is sort of consciously. I think early on, when I, like probably a lot of young photographers, would just aim their camera at anything that they thought was interesting. And fortunately, early on, I tried to look at that stuff sort of critically. Why am I drawn to this subject matter? Why did I compose it the way I did? And started to see patterns of things that emerged and certain ways of doing it that really gratified me. One of those things, and yeah, sort of a critic once described my stuff as sort of muscular compositions, which I always really thought, I loved that one. But I, you know, early on, I wanted to really fill an image with information, not that real simple, you know, ball face sports thing, but I wanted a lot of information in there. I wanted the reader's eye to meander throughout the image and still see things and go back to it again and see yet further things and maybe take a meaning from it that then may change the next time they see it. I wanted to play with the border edge of an image because, you know, it's not an objective thing, a picture. It's very, subjective in terms of what you choose to put in the frame and what you don't. And I kind of wanted at times to call attention to that, where I would intentionally have things sort of half in the frame, half out, half of a face, just to let the sort of the viewer realize there's a world outside of the frame of this image. This is just what I've selected. So I did that for a long time. Maybe the format of my camera may have changed. But ironically now, more of my work is maybe less looking at the outside world. It's more coming from internal thoughts, ideas, emotions. And I find that the images tend to be now just the opposite. They're a lot sparser. They're a lot about space and quiet. But that's, that's a 20-year evolution from that first one to this one.
So if what you're communicating is coming from a more internal place, then just going out and trying to see what's happening and mm-hmm. then taking snapshots. Do you come up with an idea or a concept in advance and then go look for things that express that?
Well, I had someone say something to me a while back. I had a friend who started a new gallery down in New Orleans, and he said to me, he's like, yeah, we'd love to show your work, Bryce, but I want something from you that's fresh. I'm just like, dude, I don't do fresh. A lot of the ideas I may have may percolate for years. I mean, years and years and years. One of the current bodies of work that I'm really putting out there in the world right now is a project called Blink of an Eye. And I'll get to that a little bit about it. Both Hurricane Katrina and 9/11 sort of lit a fire under me to take that project further along. But the seed of that idea started 5 years before all that. And I was fishing for ways to express it. With each new project I undertake, I think about what is I'm going to shoot and then how to shoot it. What's the best? Am I shooting color? Am I shooting toy cameras? Am I shooting speed graphics and Polaroid positive? What is the best medium to express what I'm trying to say? So I may have some false starts. I had one of the initial images from what ended up being called Blink of an Eye that I still adore this image, but I shot it in a way other than, I shot it with a Hasselblad, sharp focus. The rest of that project ended up being taken with toy cameras, which were kind of softer and gauzier, and they were both square, and I tried to shoehorn that original picture into the project, and in the end, it just didn't fit. It had to be edited out, and it was the seed picture for the idea, and someday I want to have a show just called Widows and Orphans of all these pictures that by themselves I still really love, but never found a home in a bigger body of work. And that series is sort of what I'm talking about, is more internalized. I'm having some of this work at the Green Hill Center coming up in December, and I'm on my way to Savannah right now for the Telfair Museums Festival. And some of this work from Blink of an Eye will be at both of those. But, I met you through this Hurricane Katrina and New Orleans shows we did. The Blink of an Eye, I showed my pre-Katrina stuff through this lens in Durham earlier. This is sort of my reaction to sort of post-Katrina, post-9/11. I'd seen so much imagery of destruction, certainly post 9/11, but really post Katrina, it just seemed, saturated with that kind of imagery. And while I certainly think that's good and valid and important work to be out there, I didn't want to show that. Rather, both of those events and myself getting older, things like this, brought up this idea to me, this sort of notion of loss, how things you take for granted can be gone overnight, you know, in the blink of an eye. It could be a building, it could be a city, it could be your youth, it could be, you know, I thought about when you're a kid, you think summertime is going to last forever, and then wham, it's time to go back to school, and it's gone, just like that. And so what I focused on were things that emoted that, you know, playgrounds, boardwalks, sort of beaches maybe. But a lot of them I shot either out of season when no one's there, or some of them were actually abandoned places like the Six Flags in New Orleans East, you know, this idea of roller coasters and stuff, but it's abandoned. But I didn't want to hammer the abandonment, but just give us an idea of this and this idea of sort of loss. And so that's why I mean when some of my newer stuff is sort of coming from inside. It's still documentary, but I think it's trying to capture an idea rather than an event.
It's still a story of human experience.
Absolutely.
Definitely. The reason I asked that was I'm taking an art history class, and we looked at a Dorothea Lange photograph of Japanese children saying the Pledge of Allegiance.
Oh, my.
And it was taken 2 weeks before they were placed in an internment camp. Mm-hmm. And so we started thinking about, you know, did Dorothea Lange see that irony in the moment that she took that shot? Probably not. Mm-hmm. Given that it was 2 weeks prior to the roundup, she probably saw it on the contact sheets later. And so we started talking about how the storytelling happens with photography.
Sure. Well, and you know,
and those epiphanies that you might have as a photographer.
Yeah. Well, and also like the thing I said earlier, it's like you can look at a picture at one time and gain some meaning from it then, and then look at it again later and get a whole other meaning. Well, time does that to photographs too. You know, when it's taken, when you see it again, ironies, all these things come through. Certainly, you know, I know that I'm attracted to certain iconography. I love shooting images with American flags in them. I love reproductions of the Statue of Liberty. There are certain imagery that I can't help but photograph. When it ends up later meaning something else, you know, it's great. It's a living thing, what a photograph means. And yes, you know, talk about how much of it comes from editing and how much while you're shooting. I was sort of an editor while I was shooting. Film was always seemed to be rather expensive to me. So I was never out there burning a ton of film. I would always look and look and wait and wait and look and look and move and change my until I saw what I thought. And I, you know, some of my more well-known images, if you go back to the contact sheets, you know, I'm lucky if there are three frames of that subject. I had a conversation the other day. I was lucky enough to meet Bruce Davidson, who's sort of a legendary photographer as well, who in fact was in that nice Y show in New York. I was at years ago. Well, I finally met him. He's 80 years old. And he was talking about what he'd been doing was going back through old contact sheets of his from assignments where they edited what they wanted for the story at that time. And then the rest of it, he's a busy guy, they're put aside and forgotten about. Well, now he's, you know, he's got time. So he's been going back through and finding all these hidden gems that never saw the light of day, however many years later, are looked at in a different context, and he's bringing them to life. And, you know, it can happen time and again. You know, certainly the stuff I was shooting when I was a really young guy, I thought was so important, you know, and you know, it probably got some attention then a little bit, but I was really flattered when I settled in Charlotte recently and had a show at a gallery, met the curator for the Light Factory there, and the day after my opening, he called me up and asked me to be in this show he was putting together, and of course I was flattered. Well, the show I had at the gallery was these sort of distressed nudes I had done, And I thought that's what he was going to want. He goes, oh, no, no, no. I went to your website. I want your street photographs, documenting America from the road from the late 80s. And I'm like, my goodness, I hadn't been pushing that work. I had, yes, it's on my website, but that he found that and was like, that's what I want. So 20-something years had passed, and all of a sudden they were more relevant with that little patina of age on them, I guess.
Perspective.
Yeah.
Just quickly, tell us a little bit about what the Light Factory is. I'm fairly familiar with their programs, but I don't know how many people around here are.
Well, the Light Factory is sort of a nonprofit photo arts center. They have, I guess, museum status, although I don't think they really behave like a museum. They do gallery shows. They have educational stuff. There's a great salon meetup group. And they try to bring speakers, and they do film there as well. And I remember when I was a kid in junior high school in Charlotte was when it started. So it's only a year old. No, it's like 30 years old now, or 40. I don't know. It's been around. And its mission was to bring, great photography to the area. I've been lucky to be teaching a few classes there, and the salon group that meets up is a very engaged group of people fascinated with photography. So I'm really glad it's there. And ironically, in post-Katrina New Orleans, I started a very similar organization, the New Orleans Photo Alliance. And we also do a festival called Photo NOLA, which, gosh, within 4 years was getting sort of international acclaim. And yet we were all volunteer run and whatever. So what was ironic is when I had to leave New Orleans to have ended up where the Light Factory was, I sort of felt like I wanted to infiltrate them. And like, what were the secrets to their longevity? I want that for my own group. How do they make it work? How do they fundraise? What is their programming? How do they staff it?
I want that for my work too.
So
any information you can share.
Yeah.
It's welcome here.
Yeah. Well, it's always, certainly in this climate, funding's always tough, so you got to be creative and innovative in, I guess, what you do.
Have a tattoo parlor in your gallery.
Right, exactly. A bike shop, do whatever it takes, I guess. But I'm glad that they're there.
Yeah. So, he took an interest in your work from the road, and I think that a lot of our audience, including myself, would love to know what it's been like to be a photographer on the road, what it's been like to get to have that life, and what it took to be able to make it having that life, and to keep your passion really alive all these, all these different projects.
Well, it certainly started right after I graduated here in Chapel Hill. I had a Volkswagen camper van and took off across America. I think I thought I was going to settle in California, my girlfriend, and zigzagged across the United States shooting like crazy. I think my girlfriend got frustrated with me at how many times I would stop the car and make an image.
That's one of the hazards of the job, right?
Yeah. It was great freedom then because, at that point I'm thrilled to be living in a van. And ironically, never ended up settling in California. Ended up going through New Orleans and being fascinated with that and came back. But obviously trying to continue that throughout my life, shooting projects. It used to be street stuff. Then it was project-oriented stuff, going out with a specific subject matter in mind and trying to make that happen. The struggle's always been really to get paid for this. I did a lot of magazine work, although, not so many of my own documentary stories ended up in a lot of those. I did a whole lot of portraits and those kinds of things. Ended up getting frustrated with that. I was with an agency who I would pitch story ideas to, and they would always say, we don't really see that there'd be any sort of national or international appeal in this, and say basically no to me, and then invariably, 4 months later, I would see that very story somewhere. And I was like, are they giving my story ideas away? They don't trust my instincts? Because clearly someone's interested in this stuff. And I ended up starting my own magazine in New Orleans that was distributed internationally through like Tower Records or somebody, and got to do really creative documentary projects. Got to hire my fellow photographers to do, you know, I encouraged them to be very creative. A lot of the stuff I saw published regionally was fairly conservative looking, and I knew that the photographers were far more creative, and I wanted to encourage that. So it was a great little run. You know, we won a big bunch of awards and had a great time, but like all
things couldn't make any money. One of like the best magazines in the world, I think, or you know, coming out of the South, it was one of the best. I'm trying to remember.
There was a guy named Samir Husni, I think, who is at Oxford, University of Mississippi, or something like that, who does a magazine review. And we launched the same year as George Magazine. You remember that? JFK Jr.'s magazine?
No, but...
And we were among the many hundreds of new magazines every year. He selected ours as like one of the top three or top five of that year, which is great. But, you know, the magazine business is tough. We actually lasted a little longer than George, which, you know, JFK Jr. on that thing, you would think they would have money.
Yeah, but I think one of the things that's so impressive about this project is it really does, you know, reinforce this notion that sometimes you have to have someone create a venue for artists to be able to do the work they want to do instead of what's produced for a market, and often a market that's kind of grown stale.
Well, yeah, and I've had to evolve, and I'm still doing that. I mean, I think now you see a lot of these folks doing what would have been maybe magazine stories. Instead, they're getting grants either through foundations or maybe corporate or something like that, or they have such a style that it's viable in a gallery art venue. So, you know, that's sort of what I've had to go to now is you know, other ways of getting the work out, other ways of getting funded, other ways of selling the work. You know, but I say for myself, I still think everything I'm going to do is going to be connected to being documentary in some nature. But artistically, my style, which continues to change, I am going further and further backwards in photo history. And, you know, I've just got a recent grant to do photo gravures. And so my processes and techniques are getting older as technology zooms forward. I seem to be going in reverse.
That may set you apart. That may be a good thing.
Well, I think it's a backlash. And, you know, I think, again, certainly for collectors, which is sort of the area I guess I'm in these days, seems to appreciate that. You know, the handcrafted, the hand of the artist in there, labor intensive, sort of combining the sort of the science and the sort of the magic and alchemy of the whole thing. Again, rather than just, not that I want to disparage too much on digital, but the push button aspect of digital. You know, Photoshop's a great tool, but just because you got it don't mean you have to use it.
Yeah, there's definitely a different kind of magic in the dark room.
Yeah, and I actually made a living when I was in New York.
A lot of people love Photoshop too, but it's different. Yeah. It's just different.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's also spawned a bit of a distrust. I think the public knows Photoshop is out there. And, you know, they can look at an image and there's always that debate about truth and how it relates to photography. And I think there's a distrust, everything from the glamour shot of the model who now we realize, wow, you know, her skin's been airbrushed and she's not as perfect as we're led to believe, to, you know, darkening O.J. Simpson's face on the cover of a magazine, to moving a pyramid, you know, like there's a distrust. I think digital photography and Photoshop has contributed to that. So,
well, it also depends on what the publication for that photograph is promising. You know, are they trying to manipulate a truth, or are they trying to communicate an idea? Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you are talking about the Six Flags photographs, you know, that is communicating a truth about human experience.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't really matter if you know, photoshopped out all the people on the cars. Because the truth is still there. Well,
there's a term they use, photo illustration. Mm-hmm. It's like, is this a photograph or is this a photo illustration?
Right. There you go.
You know, but there's, they don't have, you know, there should be a disclaimer, right? You know, this image has been retouched, you know.
Well, especially when there are implications for that, you uh-huh. know, when you're... And it is absolutely appalling to think that someone darkens someone's skin yeah. to
make it more ominous.
Yes, you know. And that, you know, then that says something a lot about the audience's racism as well.
Sure.
And well, that you're trying to perpetuate that through yeah. your manipulation. Yeah.
Which is not to say we couldn't have done stuff like that in the darkroom. I mean, mm-hmm. you can certainly that manipulate an image in the darkroom, but we were... I guess rarely accused of anything so much back then. Now it's just too easy to do. It's too tempting, you know. It's right there for you.
Yeah.
It was like 5 seconds.
Well, that has all kinds of implications for other kinds of art forms too, like writing, literature. Mm-hmm. But what do you think the term documentary means to most people, and then what does it mean to you in comparison?
Well, I always try to make the distinction between what I see as documentary and photojournalism. They're often the same, but not always. Again, the irony of timing, when I was an undergraduate, I took every photojournalism class they had here. At the time, I hate to mention over there at Duke University, you know, my nemesis, they were just starting the Center for Documentary Photography. And I really wish the timing would have been a little different where I could have accessed that, because I believe that their philosophy is more in line with what mine is about documentary, whereas you're not doing sort of spot news. It's not that moment of the day kind of image. Typically longer term projects, you know, spent with your subject, images, I would hope that have more to say, that have a lot of content you can look at and look at and look at, and individually, but then also I see documentary oftentimes as not sort of the single image concept, but you know, a whole folio of images that together tell a different story. I loved book design. I love pairing images up. I used to even show images side by side in the same frames. I think that one image facing another image creates yet another dialogue, you know, how this impacts what you see in that. So, you know, I like, you know, a documentary project to have a narrative sequence and tell a story, you know. I don't know if that really answers it, but that's sort of how I see it.
So, tell us about Land of Dreams. Why is New Orleans and Southern Louisiana the Land of Dreams to you?
Well, I stole that line from a Jerry Lee Lewis song, Land of Dreams, best place I've ever seen. And I certainly found it to be that for me. I never really planned on living there as long as I lived there. I thought I would stop off in New Orleans for maybe a year and keep going. And I stayed there 12 years the first time and 5 years the next time, because it just kept giving. It nurtured me in all kinds of ways. It's a very seductive city. It gets its claws in you, and I don't think it ever lets go. You're never really away from it once you've lived there. But it's such a rich, I call it the richest poor city in America. I think it's absolutely a national treasure in a country where we are increasingly homogenized.
Yeah, I was going to say there's some places I've lived that I can pass by on the highway and it was like I was never there. But sure. A place like New Orleans, you've yeah. got a sense of place. Well, you can stay there a week and have it.
Yeah, and really it's like the layers of an onion. I think you could live a lifetime there and still not experience and know everything about that. Now, I would say the same thing about New York City, but New York City is huge. You know, New Orleans, not so big, but there are so many unique and distinctively different cultures and an intermingling of cultures and race and culture and class. And yet it's a place that, I mean, it's had certainly bad parts of its history, no doubt, but where it encourages this expression, it encourages eccentricity, celebrates it.
Become that? How did it become a place that, you know, really embraces that kind of eccentricity that it's become so known for?
Well, I really wish I knew the answer to that. But I mean, it's certainly, again, like a lot of places in Louisiana, at times in its history, it's been one of the best places for certain things, and then the worst as well. Like, I'm certainly no expert on this, but I think some of the earliest, say, free people of color were in New Orleans, and there was such intermingling of races, and of course blending, even like what they call octoroons, quadroons, all this mixed blood stuff going on there, that New Orleans was ahead of the game in many ways. And yet, because it was ahead of the game in many ways, I don't think it had the, as much motivation for, say, civil rights to happen. So in a way, they got passed over, and then they were sort of the worst for that in many ways. But it just allowed this freedom, and you know, it's a different set of laws, it's Napoleonic code, and certainly like the city of New Orleans doesn't put restrictions on you. You know, you could, for instance, you could drink there all night if you wanted to. You have to govern yourself. Now, I've seen that be the ruin of many people as well, but it's, you know, it's free form. It's huge, you know, black culture, Cajun, Creole, huge gay community, tons of artists, and not necessarily in their own little cordoned off neighborhoods, but often, you know, side by side to each other. And I got lucky. I think in the first month that I was in New Orleans, there was a magazine stand bookstore in the French Quarter called Sydney's, where, believe it or not, you could pick up a Village Voice from New York for free, which is, I thought, was very strange. And in the first month, there was an article in the Village Voice called The New Bohemia, and it was saying, if you're a working artist, forget New York. This is in, you know, 1986. Forget New York. You can't afford to live here. If you want to be an artist, move to New Orleans, where you'll be stimulated by every sense, you know, smell, taste, touch, sound, you name it. It's cheap. You can live like a king there on nothing, which at that time was true. And I thought, I'm a genius. I'm already here. Now, of course, that's changed. I mean, it gradually changed over the years, but post-Katrina, it did a whammy on the economy down there. Not only can you, it's hard to make a living, but the cost of your living has gone up with the repairs, insurances. They did tax assessments on places, and no longer can you live cheaply, and it's even harder now to make a living, unless you're in the sort of tourism business. It's coming back. It is coming back, myself, like a lot of people, I think suffered what I call sort of post-Katrina burnout, is that, you know, you kept giving and giving and giving and going through difficulties, little subtle things that add up. Like, there's still, 5 years later, there's not a grocery store in my old neighborhood. Yeah. I had to drive all the way across town to get groceries. That seems kind of strange. Why, there's people there, why is there not a grocery store there?
And they lost a huge number of their police force.
Oh, yeah.
Then, you know, they've been hit by so many other tragedies, too. There have been more hurricanes, floods.
Oil spills.
Oil, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, I think what was really exciting for me personally, I mean, I was living in New York when that happened, but I was on a plane, you know, 2-3 days later, thinking I was just going back to temporarily help out, but that grew into something much, much more. But what was really inspiring at that time is the folks, the early comers, the early ones back in town, were people who obviously loved New Orleans, were these diehard people about not only rebuilding it, but I think a lot of us realized it was a time when a small group of people or even an individual could in fact make profound change. And all kinds of stuff happened and still happens there post-Katrina that probably would never have happened without it. There's this huge evolution of sort of green building, especially in the lower Ninth Ward, all this stuff that, you know, in New Orleans you can't tear down a historical property. Well, the whole city's historical and you can't tear down a building. So the fact that Mother Nature sort of wiped the slate clean has opened the doors to really rethinking a lot about how we live, how we build houses. And that's been just tremendously exciting. These sort of diehard, passionate people that have come back and really dove in and make the city kind of the same but new and better, I hope.
That's happened in a few places with hurricanes. Mm-hmm. How have the traditions there been impacted by that particular
disaster? Well, I was certainly very worried about that. I mean, you asked about Land of Dreams, and that was sort of what that was about. You know, we talked about editing work. You know, a lot of those images that are in that project came from other projects that are repackaged, re-edited into this sort of life in New Orleans pre-Katrina. And part of my mission for that was, again, we were seeing so many images of destruction, post-Katrina stuff. But what I was not seeing was imagery of the city before, the way it was, why it was so important, what was so unique and vital about that city, various very distinctive cultural aspects of that city. And I wanted people to see what was potentially going to be lost. With all the evacuations, you know, it was not made easy for a lot of these people to return. And New Orleans is not like, you know, we don't look to, say, our government for our support system. A lot of it's very community-based, church-based. Your neighborhood supports you in some ways. And if those people weren't able to return, what support structure was going to be in place for those people who did? I think it took longer than it should have, but I do feel now that most of that, if it's not already back, is well on its way to being back. So I'm very thankful for that. You know,
I wonder, you know, that survival of that kind of support, grassroots support culture, I wonder how much of that is due to sort of storytelling, people talking about what it was like and reminding people, you know, and using that almost as a roadmap for how to get back to that.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of your questions in your thing was about this, what makes someone Southern. Well, I think storytelling is one of those things we got down pat. Certainly if you ask any of my friends, I don't tell a short story. You know, my stories are long and they're full of detail and flavor. And I think that's a Southern thing. Like, we love to tell those stories about, you know, what makes us unique. And, you know, my parents, even when I was a kid, if they had adult friends visiting, they would warn their visitors, you know, don't ask Bryce about the movie he just saw, because it'll take you longer for him to tell you about it than for you just to go watch the movie yourself. So I could go on and on. You could tell you about the guy who I came to rescue. But I think a lot of us were passionate about getting the story out. I know you had Don Young on here.
Yeah.
You know, he's been fantastically vocal about the things that drive him in this issue. You know, the reason I had this show up in Durham recently was, and you also had Roy Lee Duvall,
yeah.
The director of the gallery over there. Roy Lee will probably tell you that I strong-armed him into having that show.
He did not say any such thing.
Well... But in a way, it's probably true. I mean, I think I'd caught wind that John Rosenthal was having a show of his post-Katrina stuff at the Greg at NC State. And John was one of the very first people I ever became aware of in this state doing fine art photography some 20-odd years ago. And it was, I thought, going to coincide with an anniversary. And I thought, what a great bookend. Let's, you know, while his show is up there, let's have sort of the before and after. And unfortunately, the Greg Museum, when they caught wind of this, couldn't have been more supportive. I mean, they helped sort of publicize, promote my show. They invited me to give a lecture there. And, you know, I think having both sides of that story is important. And John came by my show. It's great to finally meet him after all these years. But, you know, I think lots of us are out there trying to tell that story. We do get saturated with it. Down in New Orleans, believe me, we got kind of tired of hearing about it all the time. So.
Well, there is an identity in New Orleans, you know, that's separate from Katrina.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah. Although we do now, it is a marker for us. We talk a lot about, you know, this is such a pre-Katrina, this is such a post-Katrina. Of course, now we have another marker. We can say, you know, before the Saints won the Super Bowl or after the Saints won the Super Bowl. But we do, we definitely use it as a marker. Life before and life after. You know, if you're a tourist down there, it's going to look like the New Orleans you think it's supposed to be. But life is different down there for those of us down there in substantial ways. And
what has not come back?
Well, business. Although I might have to eat my words eventually. I was just there recently and talking to friends about this influx of new business. I'm not sure new industry would be the right word, but and there's a double-edged sword to that. There's a lot of folks who have this sort of, oh, this carpetbaggers. It's all these people from, I don't know, Detroit or somewhere, Chicago coming down. And yet at the same time, we're thankful for the people who are willing to take a chance on us, to invest in us. And you know, hopefully the more that happens, life and the economy and living and working there will get back to normal. Like I know a lot of my photography friends, you know, had a hard time making a living. I ended up having to leave. I started this nonprofit thinking it was going to be a career choice, and after 3.5 years of volunteering, I realized that was a bad career move.
Well, and it seems like post-Katrina, so many nonprofits started. Again, it's part of that grassroots
tons of nonprofits
support culture.
But, you know, and certainly initially, I think there was a lot of funding support for that kind of stuff. People wanted to help out with that. I think the trick for a lot of that is to sustain it. If your organization is one that's not, you know, just the immediate cleanup of the Ninth Ward, but something that's more long term, you know, it fades from the headlines, and you know, can it sustain itself? And it's an interesting challenge. But I mean, and I think I actually listened to Don's interview you had here, and one of the things he said, I'll say again, is that, you know, so much of that stuff was not the government coming to help, but it was these faith-based things, schools, universities sent whole teams of people. And granted, a lot of that was short-term, but that short-term for a lot of those ended up being longer than they thought. You know, years later, they were still working on this stuff. And like, I don't know that those will be around there forever. At some point, that will stop. But there was a great outpouring of support, not from our government, but from nonprofits and a lot of love.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about some of the photos that are in your Land of Dreams series and which ones you enjoyed taking the most.
Oh, gosh. Well, there's you know, I often will have a sense of humor in some of my pictures. One of my favorites is probably, it's called St. Marian Camp, which is an early image. You can always tell earlier images of mine because you can tell that they're 35 millimeter. They're, you know, the rectangle instead of the square. So it's an early one of a street scene that's got a kind of distraught looking man walking down the sidewalk, this weird oval window with plaster heads. And then on the roof of the building is a dog looking down. So this transposed sort of space thing. And it's got great shadows and lines. And it's kind of funny and ironic, and I really enjoyed that one, and just that, again, that's when I had the camera all the time, and just to be able to catch that, and that just that mere moment when that was happening. Another one that I love for multiple reasons is, it's hard to leave New Orleans during Mardi Gras. It's such a amazing, rich, broad subject. So many different things go on in New Orleans during Mardi Gras. But one year, I made myself leave town and go out to Cajun country, where they have a tradition called, I think in French, Carrière de Mardi Gras, which, as far as I understand, is in fact older as a tradition than New Orleans. And that day was just so fun to be there and be a part of it. It's many things. It's this sort of coming-of-age event for young men. Most communities there only allow the men of that community to take part in the ride. But the town I went to, which was Eunice, Louisiana, allowed what they said was women and Yankees to ride as well. And they would have actually considered me to be a Yankee, I think. But it's this ride through the countryside all day. These masked people, mostly on horseback, some walking with a band, and they go scaring children and begging for ingredients for a gumbo. Well, the event itself was wonderful. It's very unique and distinctive. But one of my extra secret pleasures about the images from that is that the costumes they're wearing have these conical hats, these really tall hats, and they have these painted chicken wire sort of masks, and very colorful. But I shot it in black and white. And it's amazing to me how many times people will look at these images and think it's the Klan. You know, that my sort of abstraction, removing the color from this, makes them sometimes ominous. And they did in fact, try to be scary and to scare kids and such. But, you know, obviously in no way the Klan. But
or even referencing in any way.
No, not even close. Yeah. But again, it's the payoff of looking deeper into a picture, you know, seeing it initially and like that knee-jerk reaction, oh my gosh, it's a Klan. And then looking at it and going, that's way too festive and out. And like looking in deeper into an image gets that wonderful payoff. And so, you know, in my own little subversive way, I kind of enjoy those images because of that.
Well, reaction. It plays with people's stereotypes too.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Because if that's their first instinct, without question.
Mm-hmm.
Then that says something about what their preconceived notions are of the South and that part of the South.
Yeah. But other than that, I love them all equally, Molly.
Well, I'm going to lead you a little bit because I'm really fascinated by the Mardi Gras Indians.
Yes.
I saw this. It was a documentary on that I got off of Netflix. And they were interviewing fishermen, big, burly shrimpers and fishermen who were doing these very tedious bead patterns on their costumes, and said that they would work for months and spend all kinds of money every year.
I'm intrigued by that because I had actually never associated like fishermen. Now, granted, blue collar folks for sure. So I'm intrigued about this documentary. I want to hear more about it. But
it's some PBS thing. I'll find it for you.
All right. And I think you mentioned when you were talking about this the other day how I, again, am no authority on this. You hear many different versions of the origins of this group. So I apologize if I'm not correct in some aspects of this. But very as briefly as I can possibly be, early on in New Orleans, there was an area called Congo Square where slaves were allowed to sort of perform their native rites, rituals, music, whatever. And apparently it was so passionate that I think the city fathers had second thoughts and I think maybe started to ban this stuff. Now, at the same time, runaway slaves were often taken in by Native American tribes, like the Houma Indians, among others. And some kind of interconnection happened there where, I'm not sure exactly when this started, but African Americans would create costumes mimicking Native American garb, and they were then able to then perform some of their native rituals, although under the guise of them being Native American, not African. And that, of course, evolved and changed into where sort of each neighborhood has a Mardi Gras Indian tribe. They're almost like gangs. In fact, decades ago, they were in fact quite violent confrontations when a tribe would meet another tribe. But they do pride themselves on their musical abilities and their costumes. And you're right, the beads and feathers that go into these elaborate costumes will take almost an entire year to do, will cost about, you know, what a good used car would cost. And as a point of pride, you really need to have a new, as they say, a new suit every year. Now, maybe you can change parts of it, just the breastplate, just the color of this, but it's a year-long process. And, of course, the music is a great combination of various, you know, sort of African call and response type rhythms, and then sort of this New Orleans jazz stuff. Donald Harrison is an Indian who is one of the chiefs of one of the tribes, and is also a well-known and respected jazz musician. And so it's all these cross influences in them. And they're actually a rather a rare sight. Typically, they would only come out on Mardi Gras Day in the morning in their various neighborhoods parading around, and then they would occasionally meet each other and then outperform, outdance, outpretty one another. And then they would come out on a day called Super Sunday and do it too. Now, of course, Mardi Gras Indians will tour and play nightclubs and stuff, but it was a fairly rare occurrence. You know, twice a year you had a chance to see them out on the streets, and those neighborhoods were pretty dangerous. You know, typically you wouldn't have seen a lot of tourists out there tracking down the Indians. Nowadays, I think there's a lot of folks out there trying to find them.
How do they react to that, the tourists trying to find them?
I think they like the attention, although, sadly, I mean, New Orleans, one of its Achilles heels over the years is it's had a real violent crime problem. It's been the murder capital many times. And while the tribes themselves, the violence that used to happen when they would meet doesn't come from them, unfortunately, there's been a somewhat of a resurgence of the spectators bringing weapons and shootings are happening. And I know as a photographer, when I first showed up, which was in 1986, I would go to some of these type things, social aid and pleasure clubs and Indian things. And there was probably, I don't know, maybe a half dozen photographers at one of these things. And I gotta say, I've really stopped shooting those kind of things. I go out there now, and it seems like everybody's a photographer. There's 50 photographers out there. And frankly, I'm not interested in going elbow to elbow with that. So my interests have gone elsewhere. I do think...
From that story, suddenly, it's interesting when it's something that's happening very organically, you know, less for...
Yeah.
The camera, maybe, or the tourist audience, and more for the intrinsic experience. And maybe that's a romantic view, but...
Well, I think, you know, in a way, it's like the Cajun Mardi Gras. Yes, it's 3 hours outside of town, so I don't think you're going to see nearly as many pure, you know, uncostumed visitors. I mean, even in New Orleans during Fat Tuesday, I, for instance, avoid most of Bourbon Street because it typically is like it's a spring break. It's
Cancun. It's, you know.
Yeah, it's uncostumed college kids flashing their breasts and so on and so forth. And, you know, once you've seen it once, you never want to see that again.
That's what a lot of people say about Bourbon Street, too. It's like, well, I saw it.
The sad part
is... Don't really have to again.
The sad part is that's what a lot of people think is all there is to that day.
It's such a tiny little bit.
Such a sliver.
And of the place, too. And New Orleans is actually... And it's a small community in a way, and everybody sort of knows each other. Mm-hmm. But I was shocked at what a large city it is. I mean, it's kind of a metropolis. Well, it is. But you've got some... Big buildings, and what you see shown in the movies is mostly just the French Quarter.
Yeah. We had this really big church there in the middle that a lot of us call the Superdome. It is a Superdome. We go and, you know, worship our saints there.
Yes.
But, you know, and that's a huge draw for the city. I mean, we get so many big events for that, and it's, you know, partly the tourism thing, but, you know, we've hosted so many things down there. Republican National Convention, you go on. It is that sort of Southern hospitality draw, which I actually, as luck would have it, I think is the festival that my nonprofit started. I think that's one of the reasons why it was so quickly successful. You know, if you had your choice of cities to go, there's a lot of these photo festivals out there nowadays, but if you had your choice, you know, would you prefer going to Houston or New Orleans or dang near anywhere? And New Orleans, you know, it's a wonderful city. There's so much to take in: food, music, architecture, history, you name it. You know, why wouldn't you want to go there?
Yeah, great ghost stories.
Oh yeah.
Well, but also the things that people say about the people are, well, I mean, there's stereotypes too that I've heard that I did not find to be accurate at all. But people say that the nicest people you'll ever meet are in New Orleans. That's a popular thing to say about any tourist destination, but I found it to be different there. I mean, people would invite you to stay with them, and you'd only just met them, and they really meant it.
Yeah.
And
Oh, absolutely. And that's even the outlying area around the city. I mean, I've done a few things on Cajun culture, like alligator hunting and all that stuff. And you want to talk about a group of people that are the most hospitable, that, man, they know how to, as they say, pass a good time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, couldn't be more open. And the same in New Orleans. I mean, it's a weird, like, remember how I said there's a great bumper sticker down there that says, "We're so far behind, we're ahead." And
which kind of characterizes what you were saying you're doing with your photography, right?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. But, like, you know, in a more sort of politically correct, up-to-the-minute community, you know, if I came in, Molly, and saw you, and I was like, you know, "Hey, babe, what's going on?" You go, "You call me babe," you know. And yet in New Orleans, you know, every old black grandma and drag queen walking down the street and politician and whatever is like, "Hey, babe, hey, darling, hey, this sugar, you know, what's going on?" And, you know, nobody thinks twice about that whether it's sexist or demeaning. It's just, "I might not know your name, but I love you. You're my neighbor."
Yeah.
You know, "Hey, darling, what's happening?" And, you know, I'm not sure that always flies in other places, but it is that general openness.
But if you come from another place, it's pretty easy to understand quickly within the context.
Yeah, I think so too.
That was our experience. And then there also, it was kind of funny, the humor, you know, being an outsider, how people would try to educate you. I remember asking someone, "So do you all ever," I think it was, I asked if they canoe or kayak, and they said, "Do what?" And I said, "Canoe or kayak."
We got P-row.
That's what they said. They made me go through it several times, like, "Oh, you mean P-row."
Well, and of course, you know, the great con lines, "I bet you $5 I can tell you where you got your shoes."
What is that?
It's like a French Quarter scam, you know. Like, I'll put up my $5. I'll bet you I didn't tell you where you got. Of course, where you got your shoes is on your feet. But, you know, it's always the test to see if you are, you know, a novice, a rookie. You know,
if you're a native, then you'll catch that humor right away.
And, you know, the pronunciations. You go down there and you want to pronounce street names like the French way that you think they should be. And of course, we've completely bastardized the pronunciation of everything. And look, nobody says Nolans. No, you know, it's like it's so sad to watch movies set there. It's so rare that they ever get the accent and the whatever else correct. It's almost laughable.
Well, and people almost over pronounce the French accent on words. That's not how things are said. It's never the way a French person would pronounce a French word.
Yeah. It's, well, so you know, you also, speaking of New Orleans, and you'd mentioned sort of the Southern thing before, and the storytelling. I got to say, you know, one of the people that I really gravitate towards, which is an author, Walker Percy, who shares both a North Carolina and a New Orleans connection. And, you know, I have long been a huge fan of his, and, you know, so many of his novels take place in both places. And I love him, and in a way I kind of aspire to do what he did as an author in my pictures. I mean, really poses questions sort of the status quo and your perception of things, very philosophical. And in fact, you know, a number of the smaller projects, smaller shows I have done over the years, I ultimately, you know, if I ever get to have some gigantic retrospective or some, you know, big book published in mine, I would probably title it Evening Land, which is a quote from The Moviegoer. This was one of his books, which, to paraphrase it, one of the characters is talking to the main protagonist and saying something like, you know, "It's quite an age that we live in. You know, it's a strange time, the coming of the end, the evening land. It is... I'm glad I'm not going to be around to see it." And it's basically about this sort of, you know, the twilight of the last century and how rapidly we were moving forward in technology and speeding up and losing our identity and just the strangeness of it all. And I kind of, at some point, realized that's what I've been photographing. The things that, sort of the odd idiosyncrasies of the South. I mean, there's a lot of people who, I think, shoot what they know and what they're intimate with, like Sally Mann's a great example as a photographer, her own family and such. I think I'm the opposite as a photographer. I want to photograph things that I want to know about, but don't, and I'm curious about, that maybe even frighten me. I think one of the things you had mentioned before was this sort of the South being some Christian.
Oh, the Christ Haunted. It's Susan Ketchen has a book called The Christ Haunted Landscape.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was wondering what you thought she might have meant by that.
Well, certainly, you know, I just have come from Charlotte, which even 20-something years after I grew up there, is still, you know, Jesus, NASCAR, and banking is what really seems to be that. And it really is the state and the South beyond that. And Walker Percy talks a lot about that same sort of ideal. But as a kid or young photographer growing up, things that attracted me, I grew up 10 miles away from PTL's Heritage Village, USA, during the Jim and Tammy Faye Baker stuff, and visited their home base and was just completely freaked out, terrified, you know. And, you know, as an undergraduate here, Jesse Helms was in his heyday of power, and it always baffled me. Now, you know, I certainly grew up and lived in probably little liberal enclaves of the state and just couldn't understand why this guy kept being elected. And so I went and tried to photograph him on the campaign trail and stuff. It's like, I just had to know, what is it's so strange to me that this guy is so popular and so powerful, and what is it about him? And I think it's a lot of the things, like, you know, the Cajun stuff, Gator. I know nothing about that stuff. You know, the camera is a passport to me. I get to, like, walk into rooms and places that where I just, by myself, I might not feel like I would be invited or welcome, but because I have, you know, the camera, it sort of gives me license to be here. And so it's an exploration for me with that, is diving into the unknown,
yeah,
trying to make some kind of sense of it or make my commentary about it.
Well, what do you think, you know, 10 to 15 years from now, people will look back on the work you're doing now and see reflected? Because we really are in an incredible time of flux. We're in, yeah, a time of flux with energy, certainly with politics, certainly with information technology.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think you're going to be exploring right now?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I wonder if the evolutionary path I'm on is a quantum leap away or not. You know, I think my career prior to now has been so still connected with the documentary tradition, even though, you know, I'm really trying to put a aesthetic stamp of my own on them. I'm curious. I don't necessarily think everybody always sees that thread. I want to say that will continue, even though the medium I use may be different. You know, I hope that someday, you know, the work that, yes, has been seen, but I think taken as a big body of work over a span of time, much as in the way a single image is more interesting 20 years after, you know, I think when taken as a whole, I will really have told a very maybe personalized but unique story of the South. Of course, I've shot elsewhere. I've shot in New York. I've shot out west. But I think ultimately it'll be the stuff about the South. You know, I have some friends in the area. One of the professors here in the art department in Carolina, and a friend of mine who went to Duke as a writer, they put together a project on this sort of post-apocalyptic thing, where one of the first assignments to their students was to write their post-apocalyptic resume. So, yes.
That's such a great idea.
Right? Isn't that fabulous?
Uh-huh.
So, you know, yes, technology is zooming along, but what if, you know, whatever, all this technology or electricity or whatever was suddenly wiped out, what can you do? You know, what skills do you have? And ironically, the direction I'm going with my photography is just like, wow, I won't need a battery for this. I don't need a chip. I won't need a computer. You know, I can maybe still produce images, you know.
After the apocalypse.
After the apocalypse, you know, maybe.
Wait, who are the professors who are doing that project?
I'm trying to remember his last name. Jeff, gosh, I'm just based on his last name, he's a professor in the art department here, teaches photography at UNC. Uh-huh. My friend Eric Martin, who's a writer, went to Duke, and now after many years, he and his wife and kids are back in Durham, and he runs some writing workshops, and I think they've paired up on some projects, which I can remember.
They ever teach community classes? Because I want to take one.
Well, I think a lot of Eric's stuff is very community based. I probably should let the cat out of the bag. Writer projects. He's very mm-hmm. interested in writer projects and inside and outside of institutions, where it can be very community based as well. I shouldn't speak too much for him on that.
I'll be surfing the internet trying to find. What he's offering next.
Yeah.
So, how can our audience really help photographers continue doing what they're doing and help them to be able to create what they want to create?
To help existing photographers create? Well, certainly I always encourage people to go out and look at photography, lots of photography, look at it, develop a real eye and taste for the depth and complexity of the people who are doing really great work, be able to really read an image well, develop your own technique. If you want to give money to foundations like that, great. But I love to pass on this thing that the Getty Museum out in LA, when my organization first started, we had our first fundraising auction, and I sent out this sort of email blast, liberally choosing from this. The Getty out in LA was building a new expansion to the museum, dedicated almost exclusively to photography or lens-based media. They issued a press release to the effect that photography, in their belief, was the most important medium going on right now, was likely to continue being the most important medium, and it encouraged, this is weird coming from a museum, they encouraged collectors to go out there and buy photography, and not just the work of established masters, but certainly if you're looking as an investment, to buy young emerging photographers' work, and in fact, not just buy a single image, go out and buy a whole portfolio of work. And this was the Getty Museum saying this. And so I think people, find out what it is you love in photography. There's so many different ways photography is expressed. Find the thing that really attracts you and collect it for sure. But spread the word, become literate about it, take some classes. A lot of these people now are either getting grants, I'm teaching some classes, I'm trying to expand sort of the visual literacy for photography among the public. I think that's a great way to do it.
Yeah, good. So I have to close with another signature question, which is, why do you believe that artistic expression is important in the world?
Well, I think art is like food. I really think you have to have it. I think it encourages thought. It stimulates ideas. It opens the doors for you to see things in new and different ways. Both, not even as a practicing art, just to view art, to take in art is really stimulating. And then, of course, if you're the type of person who needs to express something, what a great way. Find the thing that attracts you and let it out, because, my gosh, you don't want to keep it bottled in.
Yeah, I asked, our art history instructor, her name's Catherine Howard.
She had a great interview, by the way.
Oh, you listened?
Oh, that was a great interview.
Oh, good.
I actually want to have a conversation with her. That was a fascinating interview.
Well, if you're still in town, come to our class tomorrow night at 7 p.m.
Yeah.
But, she was saying that art, everybody says that art is something that is universal about human experience across mm-hmm. time and geographic boundaries. And so I asked her, we've talked about all these questions about what is art, and that gets redefined all the time. So if it's being redefined all of the time, how do you say that it's, something universal? And she said, art to her is the human's attempt to process the human experience. And that's really why we do it.
Yeah.
So I love your statement. I'm probably going to steal it for our solicitation letter this year.
Oh, go for it.
But that art is food, because we've been talking about what is it that we do when we bring arts experiences to our community.
I stole it from somebody anyway.
Yeah, did you? Well, we're saying that we're feeding their soul. We're feeding our souls.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah.
So thank you for that. Now, tell our audience how they can learn more about you and your work.
Well, certainly my website's easy. It is just my name.com. It's, you know, Bryce Lankard, Bryce Lankard. Upcoming, I'm on my way literally tomorrow, next day, down to Savannah. I'm taking part in the Telfair Museum's Art Festival, which goes on the next 3 days over this weekend. Starting in this December, some of my work will be featured at the winter show at Green Hill, North Carolina Center for the Art in Greensboro. And with luck, I will maybe even be living in this area soon, and certainly hope to find other places to show more of my work here. There's some great galleries and art centers here that I definitely want to bring my stuff around. So,
yeah. Is there a pretty good photography community here?
I think there's just a great art community.
Yeah.
You know, I, in my own studio, don't necessarily look at my own pictures on the walls. I have my collection of painters and other friends I've traded with over the years that stimulate me. I like to be surrounded by artists of all kinds. I think there are photographers here. There's some I know for sure, and probably others that I don't.
Have you met Allison Overton yet?
I haven't. I met Lori Verba over in Durham. Peter Filene was one of my great professors at Carolina. He's retired now and making wonderful images himself. John Rosenthal I finally met. Jeff here at the university does some really great stuff.
Again, Don Young, who just
Don Young
blows
absolutely.
My mind.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, he so is. Good. He is got so much energy and passion. It'll be fun to be in the same town with Don again if that happens.
Uh-huh. So, yeah. I can see how there will be all sorts of new energy if you two join forces.
Oh, it'd be trouble.
Yeah, I'm very glad. I'm waiting for that to happen. Someone needs to document that. Thank you so much, Bryce Lankard.
It's my pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
Really, really, really fun conversation. And I let it run a half an hour over because Cameron just had, his wife just had a baby. So his show is not running for another couple of weeks. I think he's taking a couple of weeks off. So I exploited that opportunity.
You allowed me to be more Southern.
No, it was such a good interview. I'm like, I could squeeze like five interviews out of this conversation. So I just let it keep going. So let's see, coming up, and again, you all are listening to, in case you don't know what you're tuned into, WCOM LP FM Radio 103.5 FM. We are a community radio station, Carrboro, Chapel Hill. You can also hear us in parts of Durham and Chatham County. Coming up November 29th, come to the Farrington Barn at 7 p.m. for Chatham Arts screening of the fifth quarter featuring Andy McDowell and Aiden Quinn. You can learn more about that at www.chathamarts.org. That is a great family film. We don't always show PG-rated films, so this is your opportunity to bring the whole family. And check out what's happening at the Carrboro Arts Center, www.artcenterlive.org. This weekend, they're featuring folk musician Elizabeth Mitchell. And stay tuned to what's happening at Davenport and Winkle Perry Steampunk Gallery and Cafe in Pittsburgh with the Coconuts Improv Troupe every third Friday at 9 p.m. starting in December. And also the General Store Cafe is moving towards a late night event from 10 to 1 a.m. every Friday and Saturday, I believe. And I guess that's about all that's coming up. Be sure to tune in to all of WCOM's great programs. We have Spanish programming during the day. We have a Carrboro Book Beat, the West End with Jackie Helvey, Hayes, and all kinds of good stuff. So you can tune in anytime and get great, great information. Thank you for listening. And again, thank you, Bryce Lankard.